So we're here today with Representative David Cicilline. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we wanted to talk to you today about your rising profile in Congress. You were elected in some months ago to the to a policy and communications committee for the Democrats, and you guys recently came out with a new slogan. Tell me about that and what For the People means to you.
Sure. So I was elected by my colleagues last year, kind of after the presidential election. I think there was a recognition in our caucus that we needed to increase the members of our leadership and really focus on developing a Democratic agenda and then communicating that agenda across the country. So I was elected along with Hakeem Jeffries and Sherry Bustos to be a co-chair of the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee. And we spent the first year of our work really developing this economic agenda that contrasted sort of a better deal that the Democrats were offering than the raw deal that the Republicans were offering. And that focused on raising family incomes, reducing the costs in people's lives for everything from child care to health care to higher education, and then making sure folks have the skills necessary to be successful in the 21st century. And so we did that work for about a year, and now we're in the election year, and we've kind of built on that economic agenda to really answer the question of what do Democrats stand for, which is what the question that lots of candidates and incumbents get asked. And after a lot of kind of reflection and listening to folks around the country, we settled on this idea that Democrats stand for the people. You know, the Republicans in Washington right now are fighting for the special interests and the very powerful and the billionaires and millionaires and the multinational corporations. What are Democrats doing? We're fighting for the people. We're fighting to drive down health care costs. We're fighting to invest in rebuilding the infrastructure of our country and create 16 million good-paying jobs. We're fighting to drain the swamp and end the corruption of this administration so that government can work for all Americans. And so I think, you know, we developed this idea of a kind of a very simple message of explaining who we are, who we're fighting for, and then listing some very specific things that we commit to getting done if we go back into the majority.
What are some of those very important, the couple of the top ones that you think are important?
So I think the most important one for sure is health care. Health care costs are increasing as a result of many of the actions of the Trump administration. They're going to increase more. And so people are seeing their deductibles go up, their premiums go up. The Republicans are actually in court right now trying to fight to take away the protection for coverage for pre-existing conditions. It's just hard to believe. So this commitment to drive down health care costs with a particular focus on prescriptions, which continue to rise very high and drive health care costs broadly, we have a very specific proposal to help drive down prescription drug prices by allowing the government to negotiate discounted prices with pharmaceutical companies through the Medicare program. So driving down health care costs, driving down premiums and prescription drugs. The second one is to really grow the economy and create 16 million full-time good-paying jobs by rebuilding America, our roads, our bridges, our ports, our transit systems, our schools. The federal government needs to be a full partner in rebuilding the country. And the third issue is really a commitment to break the connection between money and politics and really drain the swamp and end the, you know, the self-dealing. And there's a whole suite of bills that focus on disclosure, public financing, reversing Citizens United, a bunch of other things that will finally make the government work for the American people and not for the special interests.
So as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, you've recently joined the Medicare for All caucus.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I think the caucus is a group of people that are committed to making sure we have a healthcare system that works for everyone. Medicare is one of the most efficient delivery systems in the world. Most people get Medicare, are happy with it, and there are a number of proposals that will allow people to buy into Medicare, particularly people in that age group of, you know, 45 to 64 that are not yet eligible for Medicare or Medicaid. So, you know, I think this is really a commitment of a group of individuals committed to building upon the success of the Affordable Care Act, but making sure that we make affordable health care available to everyone. There are a number of different models to do it. The Medicare system, as I said, is a very efficient system, and so that, I think, is a very good thing to look at.
Do you think Medicare for All means that there's still room in the system for private insurance, for employer-based insurance? Should everyone just have Medicare, sort of like a system in Britain, or Should it be people have the option but could also opt not?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as a certainly, I think there will always be private insurance, and I think there will always be people who are interested in the private insurance market. But I think broadly, making sure that people have the ability to buy into the Medicare system, which is an efficient and affordable system, is a good option. But, you know, I think we should, this is a complicated area. We should be willing to listen to lots of good ideas, you know, try some things to see how they work. But all I know for sure is I hear from Rhode Islanders every day about their inability to meet their health care costs. It is a source of tremendous anxiety, people worrying, like, do I have enough coverage? Can I get insurance? Will my children be covered? I mean, this is on the minds of virtually every Rhode Islander in some form. And you know, in the richest, most powerful country on the planet, we ought to be able to figure out how we can have a healthcare delivery system that's affordable, that provides high-quality care, and that people have access to.
One of the things I was talking to some of your admirers about is that you're interested in antitrust law, which is an area of law that I think even people who are interested in this sort of stuff, their eyes can glaze over. Why should Rhode Islanders care about the Sherman Act, should care about monopolies, and what can you do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually a very important issue. You know, I don't know that everyone has a great familiarity with monopsony or monopoly or the Sherman Act. But I do think people understand that the economy is not working for them. You know, we have an economy right now which is working very well for the people at the very top. But people are seeing an economy that there is a tremendous concentration of wealth in the set of one small group of people, and everyone else is struggling to get by. Consumers are seeing less choice in the marketplace. They're seeing prices go up. They're seeing mega merger after mega merger where they're really losing power as consumers. So people may not have the, you know, familiarity with all the terms, but people have a real sense that the economy is changing and there's this enormous concentration of economic power, maybe the most concentrated in our lifetime, and it's not working for them. And so what the antitrust subcommittee focuses on is how do we create competitive solutions to that, and how do we make sure that workers and consumers are protected? And so I think it's an area where there is going to be a growing interest. I mean, the recent events with Google and Facebook and the kind of platform dominance that these two gigantic technology platforms have and their ability to control information and entry to the market is really significant. And so I think my colleagues and I are very focused on that, and I think in a kind of renewed way, because people understand we need to figure this out and come up with some solutions. We've got to be careful because we want to do it right, because if you impose the wrong solution, it can have a really adverse impact. But we've got to address this sense that the economy is not working for everyone, and figure out how this, you know, very strong concentration of economic power can be checked with good competitive policies.
Let's talk politics. Are you going to run for Joe Crowley's position in the leadership?
You know, I'm singularly focused on one objective, and that is to take back the House. I think, you know, I've enjoyed serving in the leadership, and if my colleagues are so inclined, I would love to stay serving the leadership. I think it's too early to know kind of in what position, but it won't matter, frankly, or it won't matter as much unless we take the House back. And so my focus has really been doing everything I can to earn my reelection, but also to help Democrats around the country to make sure that we go back into the majority. And I think when that happens, there will be a lot of opportunities to continue to be a leader in the Democratic caucus, and I hope my colleagues will continue to give me that opportunity.
So let's say the Democrats take over in November, and let's say you get the chair of some committee that has subpoena power. What is the first thing that Chairman Cicilline is subpoenaing the Trump administration for?
Well, I mean, I think there's a tremendous concern about the behavior of many members of the Trump cabinet and the Trump family that it seemed to be using public office as a way to enrich themselves. I think, you know, we continue to think it's important to see the president's tax returns. I mean, one of the most disappointing things for me has been, you know, the Judiciary Committee has important oversight responsibilities. And we have that responsibility no matter who's in the White House to really provide oversight to the administration. And our colleagues on the Republican side have been unwilling to engage in any meaningful oversight. We've sent dozens of letters, tried to use inquiries, of resolutions of inquiry, using every kind of procedural mechanism we can to say to the committee, we're not doing our job by bringing in administration officials to get answers to these questions about the self-dealing and about the ethical lapses in this administration. So, you know, I hope we will do a kind of responsible review of the administration's behavior. And obviously there are a number of policies where in the, you know, environmental area where they're rolling back tremendously environmental protections and protection for clean air, clean water. There are, I think, very significant changes in the Justice Department in terms of their policies with respect to immigration and zero tolerance. And so I think we'll have an opportunity to go through kind of every department and have real oversight hearings, which I think the American people are entitled to see. Mm-hmm.
So there has been some discussion after the recent Helsinki conference. There have been some people who have been pretty critical of President Trump, the way he handled that. What do you make of it? What do you make of some of his recent statements about Europe and Russia and sending the possibility of sending an ambassador over to be questioned by Russia?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to capture in words the disgust of having watched the President of the United States standing on foreign soil next to the thuggish dictator Vladimir Putin and essentially siding with him over the extraordinary men and women in the intelligence community in this country. It's really unprecedented. And it's a kind of ongoing pattern of this unwillingness in any way to acknowledge the serious threat that Russia is and to voice any criticism of Vladimir Putin personally. I mean, this is an individual who's led the military, you know, takeover of a sovereign country in Crimea, who has used tactics that include jailing journalists and his political opponents, who is engaged in military action in Syria, undermining the national security interests of the United States, and who personally led an attack on our democracy to attempt to help Donald Trump become president and undermine the chances of Hillary Clinton becoming president and to sow discord in the United States. 12 Russian intelligence officers were just indicted for that. It involved breaking into the DNC and extracting materials and then distributing them. I mean, this is really unspeakable violence to our democracy. And the idea that the President of the United States would, in that opportunity that he had to stand with him, to call him out publicly and say, the American people decide who their elected officials are, not a foreign adversary, and don't you ever do this again. And by the way, here are a set of additional sanctions we intend to pose to make sure you don't do it again. And by the way, our intelligence community says they're up to it again. And so it was so horrifying to watch that press conference. And I think it raises a real question of, like, why is the President of the United States advocating for Russia over the men and women in our own country?
Why do you think that is?
I mean, I don't think we know yet. I mean, there's clearly a reason. Now, there's certainly some admiration for kind of this strong man that Putin is. I mean, this is our president who called Erdogan to congratulate him on his referendum, who invited Duterte to come to the White House. I mean, this is a president who has admiration for these authoritarian leaders, which is inconsistent with our values in this country, called Kim Jong-un an honorable man. I mean, this is a man who has imprisoned tens of thousands of his own citizens. So it's hard, you know, there's some admiration, but you have to think there's more to it. Look, we know that the Russians engaged in a very sophisticated campaign to help Donald Trump. We know the Russians met with the Trump campaign at Trump Tower. They said they had dirt on Hillary Clinton. The president then lied about that and said it was about adoptions, and we know that's not true. He then fired Director Comey and went into the Oval Office and yucked it up with the Russians and said, oh, thank God I got rid of this guy. He was really a problem. I think there's a lot of evidence before us that the president is very worried about what this investigation will reveal. He's tried in every way to undermine it and to attack the Department of Justice, the FBI, Robert Mueller. He's certainly acting like he's worried about something. But again, I don't think we know yet. I think it's very important that Mr. Mueller be permitted to finish his work, he be protected from any political interference, and that the president to stop trying to undermine all the institutions that are going to be important when this report is done. He's attacking the media. He calls them the enemy of the people. He attacks the courts. These are institutions which have made our country the envy of the world, and they're going to be institutions that will be very important when Mr. Mueller is done and his report is delivered. And so what I think the president is doing, he's engaged, and his allies in Congress, are trying to undermine these critical institutions because they understand what's coming, and they want to set the table so that they can cast doubt on what will, I think, be very damaging to this administration.
You're very critical of President Trump, obviously. Do you think that he has crossed the line into an impeachable offense? And if not, where do you think that line is?
You know, I don't know that, you know, I always think of, like, what are the logistics of making that happen? I think the betrayal of American values and the betrayal of our country in that press conference are significant. I think it's really important to wait till Mr. Mueller completes his work. Because, look, when you remove a president of the United States, this is a very consequential action. It undoes the election of the American people. It is rare, as it should be. But there is growing evidence that this president is not fit to hold office, and I think it's really important that we wait until this investigation is concluded, because it's going to require, if that is to happen, it's going to require, as has in every other instance, bipartisan support to do it. It has to be that the American people are convinced that this president must be removed and that there's evidence to support that. And, you know, I think Mr. Mueller will answer that question in large part when he delivers his findings to the Congress.
So I wanted to ask about the Peter Strzok hearings. You were very forceful in your questioning and in your back and forth with the majority there, and got some attention. As I mentioned off mic, you were referred to by Colbert, I believe, as Congressman Andy Cohen.
I'm a big fan of Andy Cohen, so that's good.
What do you make of the reaction to that hearing? What have you been hearing from Rhode Islanders about that hearing?
I mean, I've heard from a number of Rhode Islanders who said they saw me, and thank you for standing up, and thank you for raising my voice and making sure that what that hearing was all about was really made clear. It was a very kind of frustrating hearing in that, you know, Peter Strzok was interviewed for 11 hours in a deposition and then I think 8.5 hours in a public hearing before the committee. And it was very clear that the Republicans brought Peter Strzok before the committee not because they had any interest in actually hearing the information he had to share with them, but that they were intending to promote this narrative about Peter Strzok having some bias against Donald Trump, and therefore the Robert Mueller investigation should be completely discredited. Of course, Peter Strzok has nothing to do with the Robert Mueller investigation, but they had the benefit of these text messages in which he expressed opinions about Donald Trump, Chelsea Clinton, Bernie Sanders, so a number of people, but in particular about Donald Trump. And what Peter Strzok made clear is that, look, I had a personal opinion, but what we're trained as FBI agents is to set aside our personal opinions and base our work on the evidence and the law. They do that every single day. It's not only his conclusion that he did that. The IG, the Inspector General, who did a very exhaustive analysis and review of this, issued a 500-page report, interviewed lots of people, reviewed many, many tens of thousands of documents, came to the same conclusion, that none of the personal opinions of Peter Strzok affected any of the judgments made, and then all the judgments were objectively reasonable. So this was an effort just to kind of focus on these tech messages and, again, set some framework to just undermine this investigation. It was very disappointing to me, because to see my Republican colleagues attack the FBI, attack the Department of Justice, attack the integrity of the men and women who risk their lives to keep us safe. You know, the president made a stop early in his term at the wall that has the names of our intelligence officers who died in duty, who are very often not publicly recognized because of their clandestine work. But these are men and women who are all over the world doing very dangerous work to keep us safe. And the idea that my Republican colleagues use this as an opportunity to bash them and bash the agency in order to protect the president of the United States for his wrongdoing, I think was disgraceful. I think the American people saw for what it was. They weren't providing oversight. They were acting like they were on the defense team for Donald Trump. So I tried to, as much as I could, force the chairman of the committee to allow Mr. Strzok to actually answer the question. And on the rare occasions when they did, I think they were they saw why they didn't want him to answer, because he was thoughtful and smart and answered them directly.
So you were a defense attorney. If you had a case, a client, and you found out that one of the people investigating him had sent these sort of text messages about your client, you'd probably argue that he was biased, right? You would probably use that to try to impeach his credibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not that it's an unfair question. It's certainly a fair question. Mr. Mueller, the minute he learned of it, he removed him. The IG did a report saying it didn't affect the investigation or any of the decisions. So we know that. I'm not saying it's an unfair question, but having listened to Mr. Strzok and heard the other witnesses and read the IG report, the Republicans know that Peter Strzok's personal views about Donald Trump had nothing to do with the investigation and certainly has nothing to do with the ongoing investigation. And they also know Robert Mueller, who's a Republican, Christopher Wray, a Republican, the leadership. So this notion of somehow, you know, Peter Strzok's personal opinion is going to change anything, it's not. And they know that. And this was really an effort to just sort of smear the investigation. And Peter Strzok himself said, look, I regret having texted those things. I regret having expressed that personal opinion. It played no role in my judgment in this investigation. And he also said, look, I recognize why people would have a question asked me based on that, which I'm happy to answer. And he answered it. So I don't think it's an unfair question. I think what was unfair and really wrongheaded was an attempt to use this as a way to just undermine and attack the entire department and the brave men and women who work there. And equally importantly, to undermine the work of the special counsel, which I just think is outrageous.
So the hearing itself got a little heated. There was quite a bit of back and forth. What would you say to somebody who would just say, you know what, I'm tired of this, you know, sort of carnival atmosphere and might be critical of your participation in a hearing that was more, a little bit less C-SPAN, a little bit more, I don't know, pro wrestling or something,
yeah,
whatever it was?
No, look, I told my colleagues, both my Democratic colleagues and my Republican colleagues, I think that was a very bad day for the committee. I think people who are watching that think, oh my God, this is Congress. So I think it's really unfortunate. I we have a choice as Democrats when an issue like this comes up. Do you just not participate? Do you not go? Do you let them engage in what is obviously a partisan propaganda kind of effort? And we thought it was important to stand up and defend the Department of Justice, defend the FBI, and protect Mr. Strzok from being kind of mistreated by the Republicans who wouldn't let him answer a question. It's always a kind of difficult balance. But I do think people want us to set the record straight, and they want us to raise our voices in support of the institutions that make our democracy work. But, you know, I much prefer they film me when I'm working with Peter Marino on the CREATES Act to drive down prescription drug prices, or Tom Reed from New York on my Make It in America Manufacturing Act. So, you know, there's a lot of really good bipartisan work that happens. That doesn't very often get a lot of television time. It's not as fun to watch, I guess. But I don't think it was a good day for anybody on the committee, because I think people watch it. It fed into the kind of cynicism that people already have about government.
So I had two more questions for you. One is, how do Rhode Islanders benefit from having somebody in Congress who is gaining a higher profile, moving up the ranks of leadership, is seen as a future leader of the party? Why should Rhode Islanders care that you have often been described in recent months, years, as an up-and-comer?
Well, I mean, I hope that the most important thing is that I fight every day for Rhode Island, and I'm, as a member of the leadership in that House, I'm, you know, at and in every one of our leadership decisions about what bills we will make priorities, what we'll fight for, what our response will be to actions by the Trump administration and the Republicans. So making sure Rhode Island has a voice at that leadership table every day is valuable, because I look through that lens in all of my work of, like, how will this benefit Rhode Island? Is it good for Rhode Island? Is it not? And just increasing the voice of Rhode Island in all those conversations, I think, is a benefit to our home state.
So if the Democrats win in November, should Nancy Pelosi serve again as Speaker?
No, I think the Democrats, I hope, will win. And it will, I think, depend on what the membership, you know, we're going to have a lot of new members that will bring us into the majority. And I think, you know, there is a lot of interest for some new faces in our leadership, and we have tremendous talent. And so, you know, I think that will happen kind of in a natural way. But I think, you know, there are great candidates. I have great colleagues, particularly that I've worked with through my work on DPCC. And I think there's a real hunger for some new faces.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.